This is episode 15 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu, and I'll be talking to you today about GNU and Linux and lots of Unix-y things. It's going to be a kind of random show, but I think we can have some fun with it nevertheless. So let's get started. First thing I wanted to go over, of course, is listener feedback. There's been a fair amount of listener feedback. I really probably can't get to it all. As I always keep saying, there's lots of emailing going back and forth with anyone who contacts me, so if I don't mention it on the show, it's for no good reason. So, someone named John, emailed me about Ardour 3, about a really interesting project, which you can watch or learn about at lac.linuxaudio.org/2012/video.php?ID=6. And that's not Ardour 3 exclusively. What it is Ardour 3 and video synchronization. So if you've got your film project and you need to do your sound mix, being able to mix your video, or your sound rather, while watching the video that actually goes along with it is kind of a big deal. Although it's not as big of a deal as you might think, but it's something. And someone's working on a technique where Ardour 3 could basically have a video viewport on it, essentially, so that you could mix your audio and reference your video as you go. It's important. It's significant. There's another project similar to that called XJDEO, I think. xjadeo.sourceforge.net. And again, that's just kind of like one of those things that I know it exists. I don't use it myself, really, because I just, so far, I've not needed it. I am pretty satisfied with the old school method of click tracks, where if you need something specific to happen in the picture, like a gunshot or something, then in your temporary audio track while you're editing video, you put a little click there, or a beep, or something, even your own voice saying, okay, insert gunfire here. You know, something like that. So that when you then take all your audio to your audio editor, you don't have to worry about the video so much, because I have found, even in the fairly high-end audio video stuff that I've used in the past, there's an element of it getting out of sync. And so you'll sit there and adjust all your audio and line everything up exactly as you believe it's going to be, and then you export everything and bring it back into your video editor, and suddenly like half the cues are a second off or something like that. It's really annoying, and it only takes once or twice for you to kind of lose confidence in the whole system. Click tracks, I've never really had a problem with. It just kind of works. And that way you know, in your video editor, this is exactly where something is supposed to happen. And so you hear it in your audio editor, you place that gunshot, or that beep, or whatever you need to, a door opening, whatever sound effect you need to insert, you put it there, where you had the click, get rid of the click, export your audio, and sure enough, it all just plays, and video plays, and the audio plays, and everything's in sync, everything happens on cue correctly. Very satisfying feeling when it works. And if it doesn't work, then you start to question why you're even bothering. And I guess that's kind of where I got to well before getting to Linux. Even when I was doing multimedia, or once I started doing a lot of multimedia on Linux, like video and audio, it didn't even occur to me at first to think, oh, I should find an audio editor with a video window so that I can edit audio to the video. I never bothered. I never thought of it. But just because I don't use it doesn't mean other people don't want it. So, and I realize that. So these are good projects to be aware of and to keep an eye on. So thank you for letting me know about that, John. There was another email, an email and a couple of people on IRC mentioned this to me about how in the previous episode, 714, I had interviewed, of course, Scott L. from the Ubuntu Studio project, and he was talking about this idea of workflow-based environments, where if you sit down at your computer and think, okay, today I'm going to do a podcast, then you switch over to this podcast identity or profile, and you've got quick access to all your podcast tools. You know, you've got Audacity, or you've got, well, yeah, Audacity and maybe Jammin or something like that. And, well, I don't know, for podcasting, my workflow is so simple, it's Audacity. So let's say you're sitting down at your computer and you think, I'm going to write some music today. So you sit down and you switch over to that activity. QJack Control starts for you. QTractor starts for you. Jammin starts in the background. AmSynth starts. And now you're already set up. Everything's configured. Everything's got the right permissions, or the real-time permissions, things like that. You're ready to go. And the next afternoon, you sit down at the computer and say, okay, now I'm going to make a video. And so you go into your video profile, and there's Kaden Live already started for you. And here's Dolphin in another workspace so that you can look at all your media and whatever else you use, Blender on another workspace, you know, whatever. That was a cool idea. I got really excited about it as we were talking, and people emailed me or IRC'd me and said, hey, Klaatu, why didn't you mention KDE Activities when he started talking about this, because that's exactly what KDE Activities is supposed to be all about. And people were really surprised that I didn't mention that at all. And frankly, I'm a little bit surprised myself. I'm not really sure why I didn't think to mention KDE Activities in that conversation. My head must have just not been there. But to be fair, or I guess in my own defense, up until like literally KDE 4.8, which I don't even run every day, but up until that time, I could never even get Activities to really do what I understood Activities was supposed to do, which is exactly what we're talking about. Like, you say, okay, I'm going to sit down and do this activity, this thing that I normally do using this set of applications. And you switch to that activity, and you suddenly have a layout that is conducive to that activity. You've got applications already open to help you along with that activity, whatever. I couldn't get KDE Activities to do that until 4.8. And it wasn't actually, I think coincidentally, the day after the interview with Scott, that I sat down in front of some system, I don't even remember what distro or why I was trying it, running KDE 4.8 and tried an activity. I switched to some other activity and it actually did exactly that. You know, it launched all these applications. Well, actually it tried to launch a bunch of applications. Whatever I was trying didn't have like 2/3 of the applications that the activity wanted to call. It was very strange. But the point was that I could see where I finally see the reality of what they had been saying all along, that Activities was going to bring to the table. Whereas before, I have not had that experience. I'll go to some other activity. There you go. You're in a new activity. The little label on the side of your desktop changes. And that's all it was. So until 4.8, I hadn't seen what Activities was supposed to really be, which I understand and I have no problem with, but that's probably why I didn't think to mention that, because up until very recently, I haven't even seen it work the way that they sort of talked about it at the very beginning of KDE 4. So I think it's cool that 4.8 has that working now, and I think that Ubuntu Studio could potentially, as one of the people who emailed me said, maybe I could put Ubuntu Studio in touch with the KDE people and kind of get them talking about how Activities might really, really add a whole other dimension to, Dave, I think it was. Dave emailed me about that. And it could add a whole new dimension to Ubuntu Studio. And in fact, if you go to yvonne.fomintgroup.org/blog/2012/05/10/activities-in-the-plasma-desktop, then you can read about Ivan Kuchik, who I seem to always talk about every 6 months or so on the show, maybe 8 months. And he's kind of trying to figure out ways that Activities could be used in the real world. So this is definitely one of those ways. So thanks everyone for the feedback. Thank you very much. I always appreciate getting feedback, even if I don't read the email on the show. So let's talk about some other stuff. So related, sort of, to Ubuntu Studio, which I covered last episode with Scott, is, of course, my own little contribution to the multimedia on GNU Linux movement, and it is known as Slacker Media. Slacker Media is really just a bunch of notes that I put together about how to understand the way that multimedia works on Linux, and I use Slackware as the system upon which you run all of your multimedia applications, because I feel that when you're in multimedia, one of the things that you value very greatly is stability, because when you sit down to make some music or to make a video or whatever, the last thing you want to be doing is troubleshooting why your computer isn't working in some expected way, because certainly you have creative things to think about, and chances are, unfortunately, because multimedia is not easy, you'll also have your fair share of troubleshooting why an audio clip isn't as cool as you thought it should sound, or a video effect isn't quite working, or whatever. So there's a lot to worry about, and the last thing you want to worry about, for me, is why your computer suddenly wants to boot to a kernel that got updated last night without you realizing it, and isn't optimized for your production, or doesn't work, whatever. So Slacker Media is just a tutorial, essentially. It's a book. And it is a book that has been recently updated. A couple of people have been trying out Slacker Media for me, or for themselves, but keeping in touch with me and letting me know kind of where things are unclear or whatever. I really appreciate those kinds of like beta testers, I guess, and I do try to be as helpful as I possibly can for those people. So if you want to try out multimedia on Linux and you want to try that out on Slackware, then you could do yourself a favor by going to slackermedia.info and reading up on how that's kind of done. The advantage to Slacker Media, the text, the book itself, is that it gives you a background on Slackware package management, which I think is a greatly misunderstood topic. It gives you an explanation of how the multimedia programs work together. Because as I was talking to Scott about on the previous episode, and something that I've even written about for the Libre Graphics magazine, or rather my friend has, the thing about multimedia on Linux is that there is no big, gigantic, one-stop shop for your multimedia needs. And that's not something that proprietary software tends to push. Or rather, because that is something that proprietary software tends to push, the one-stop shop. So that if you announce to the world one day, as a typical computer consumer, I'm going to be a filmmaker, then you know exactly what you need to go out and get, right? You need to go get this computer of this specific brand with this application set, and that's it. That's all. That's all you need. This computer, that application set, you know, camera, lights, whatever. But, I mean, in terms of the technology, the post-production side, that's all you need. Computer and this one application package and a bunch of add-on packages and a bunch of other application sets that you find out about a little bit later. But in terms of entry level and, hey, how confused are you right now? There's plenty to be confused about in multimedia. So going to a vendor and saying, I want to be a musician, and they say, okay, well, here's the computer and here's the software package that you need. That's pretty simple. That makes it really easy. It's not necessarily meaning that those software applications are easy to use, but at least there's kind of something to latch on to. Okay, this is the application that I need to learn. Believe me, that can be insurmountable in itself. Now go over to GNU Linux, where it's the typical thing of, okay, well, wait a minute. So I want to do Linux. Now, what do I need? I need a computer, and I need to make sure that all the parts are going to be compatible with Linux. And then I need to decide on a distribution. I mean, heck, I know people who've been running Linux for 8, 9, 10 years and still haven't settled on a distribution. You know, imagine being a newcomer, or don't imagine, because we were all newcomers at one point. But there's that issue. There's the normal, like, okay, I'm getting into GNU Linux now, where do I start confusion? And then there's this confusion about, okay, now I want to do video editing. And you look up video editing on Linux, and all you see are a billion posts about how confusing it is and how bad it is and how terrible it is, and then you see a couple of posts about how great PityV is, and then how great Kdenlive Live is, and how great OpenShot is, and then you see some random post by a weird guy online about how you should do all your video editing in Blender. Just you have no idea where to begin. And then let's say that you finally decide, okay, I'm going to do Kdenlive Live. That's not a one-stop kind of shop. I mean, I would argue that even the proprietary stuff isn't, even though it claims to be. But Linux doesn't even claim that. You know, it says, okay, this is Kdenlive Live. This is going to be your editor and small-time compositor and really strong, powerful color corrector. But then you need something to go out to. Where do you go for your special effects? Where do you go for your sound mix? You know, all these different things. So it's a piecemeal kind of thing in the best possible way, because if you don't like Ardour, then you can use Audacity. If you don't like Audacity, you can use QTractor for your sound mixes. You know, whatever. If you don't like Caden Live, then you could maybe use PidiV or something like that, or OpenShot. Whatever your preference is, you've got a lot of options and a lot of choices. There's a lot of power in that, but it gets very confusing. And understanding how they're supposed to work together can be very confusing. Slacker Media goes over all that stuff, tells you how these pieces are supposed to fit together so that you can end up with a comprehensible and kind of cohesive workflow for yourself. So that's what Slacker Media is. I think it's really good. I've updated it based on a lot of beta testing from my friends online, and I've tried to make it more generic. For a while, I was trying to kind of keep up with Slackware proper and kind of talk about exactly what was in the Slack builds repository versus Slack package stuff that shipped with Slackware. And at this point, I'm just kind of like, if I can write it very generically, then it should, in theory, not really, it shouldn't matter if someone updated the Audacity build from 1.3.12 to 2.0, which someone did, actually, and I'm on Audacity 2.0 now and highly recommend it so far. So it's a little bit more generic in the sense that it doesn't use version numbers. It tries not to talk about specific features that may be here one feature in one release and not in another. But I find it's just as informative, if not more so. It's also been drastically expanded with content that includes the QTractor user manual that I wrote for the QTractor project. That's about 100 pages of really, really good information. It also includes some stuff that didn't make it into the QTractor user manual. And it's also got an article or a set of articles that I wrote for opensource.com and took in here and kind of modified a little bit about Caden Live and how to use that. And that's a really, really informative set of sort of articles. So it's essentially Slacker Media at this point is essentially three different things. One is the generic overview of Slackware and the multimedia way of doing things on GNU Linux, and then some specific information about QTractor and Caden Live, mainly because those are just the two things that I've written content on. There's pictures now. It's pretty darn complete. I'm talking about it because I guess I'm kind of proud of it. It's actually pretty neat. It is available as plain text, as an EPUB, or as an online document. It's also available via Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Lulu.com in a printed edition. I went ahead and sent it out for actually paper edition. So if you want a paper copy of it, you can actually purchase one. I don't make any money off of it. I took the discount on Lulu.com. I don't know why they call it a discount. It's a discount for you, not for me. I reduced the price to the lowest thing they could possibly, they allowed me, which I imagine makes sure that they still make some money off of it. So me personally, I'm not getting any money out of it. It's just really more of something that I did for, you know, what do they call it? Vanity publishing. You know, I mean, it doesn't really matter that it's on paper, but you can certainly get a paper copy if you want. And I'll also probably bring some paper copies to Southeast Linux Fest. So if you want to buy a paper copy at that point, you certainly are welcome to. You are certainly not obligated to. Like I say, I'm not making any money off of it. It's just kind of for fun or a handy reference to have on hand. Handy reference to have on hand? That's weird. And as always, you can get the docbook source code for all of those things, which is getting kind of complex now because now I've got builds. I've got docbook source code. And you can do a make build or a make Slacker Media for the combined thing that is Slacker Media, QTractor, and Caden Live. You can do a make QTractor to just get the QTractor manual. I think that's actually it. But obviously you could do make HTML, make PDF, stuff like that. So it's getting kind of complex now, but it's cool. I like it. It's a neat project. I encourage you to check it out if you're interested in that sort of thing. Related to that, again, sort of, is another free EPUB that's out there. It's called the Debian Administrator's Handbook at debian-handbook.info, and Digzit in IRC let me know about this actually just last night, and it's kind of a neat one. I think I've seen this, like, I think this started as like a Kickstarter project or something to get the the text from its original publisher or something like that. I could be getting this mixed up with another project. Whatever it is, wherever it came from, I haven't read it all. I mean, I just found out about it last night, but it's pretty cool. Again, you can get it from like lulu.com for, you know, whatever it costs. I don't really know. I think it's like $45 ish. I think it's like 44.9 British pounds. So, and then I guess there's shipping there. So it's not cheap, but I mean, it's a 495 page book for crying out loud. So it's got a lot of information in it. I kind of skimmed the EPUB version of it. So it's a really good book. It's a big book. It's got a lot of great information. I'm probably going to buy the hard copy pretty soon here because I don't run a whole lot of Debian, and it's actually the numbers of the Debian servers here are dwindling as the computers just start dying that it was running on. But it's still really good information, and Debian has their own way of doing things, and so having a book that kind of spells all that stuff out, I can imagine that being very, very handy. So that's debian-handbook.info. You should check that out if you're a Debian person or if you want to be a Debian person. That could be very, very informative. Now, speaking of EPUB readers, there is a very cool Firefox plugin that I just found out about. It is, I think, actually kind of brilliant. It hasn't changed my life, but it's made my life better. And it's called EPUB Reader, all one word. And it is a free add-on that you can get to in the normal way. Just go to Tools, Add-ons, and search for EPUB Reader, all one word. As of this recording, I think their version is like 1.4 or something like that. All it is a 1.4.2.1. All it is an in-the-browser EPUB Reader, which doesn't really seem like that big of a deal. But I was sitting back trying to, you know, kind of bug test Slacker Media and some other EPUBs that I was generating, and I realized that I didn't love either of my EPUB readers. FB Reader is okay, but the CSS on FB Reader is just so plain. I mean, it's really plain. And I'm a plain text kind of guy, but I mean, if I'm gonna do an EPUB, I might as well make it look pretty. So FB Reader, while I love it because it is so lightweight, it is also just really bare bones. And then there's, of course, Calibre, which sort of is the opposite end of the spectrum. It's a big application. It's really hefty. I mean, you install it on your computer and your computer weighs like an extra 3 pounds. It's a big application and it feels big. You launch it and you're like, wow, there went a gigabyte of my RAM. And I don't mean any of that in a disparaging way because I use Calibre, to read ebooks on my other computer and it does great. It works fantastic. I'm really happy with it. But at the same time, sometimes you just want something kind of in between that really, really bare bones and that really, really featureful kind of application that will convert PDF to EPUB and vice versa, which Calibre can do. You don't need all that all the time. This EPUB Reader plugin for Firefox is perfect, and it makes perfect sense too, because EPUB, as we've already discussed on a previous episode, is just HTML. It's HTML and CSS zipped up into a container that we call EPUB. And it's really just a zip container. It's pure zip. So it's really, really neat to be able to view that stuff that sounds like it should be viewable in a browser anyway, and now you can view it in your browser, but with all the niceties that come along with the EPUB format. You know, you've got the table of contents, you've got the sense that you're turning pages, and kind of the correct flow of information, and you've got some CSS stuff that you can do. So you get just enough of the I would think of as the basic features of EPUB without going, for me, what would be overboard with like conversion and stuff like that Calibre does. So EPUB Reader for Firefox, highly recommended. You install it and then it places a little EPUB icon in your little toolbar on Firefox, and you can go into that interface and it'll sort of treat that as a library, and then you can choose your books, or you can just go to File, Open, and open a new EPUB and start reading it right there from Firefox. It's just really handy. If you're like me, you've probably got Firefox open all day anyway, so why not have your EPUB reader right there in one of the tabs. So check that out if you want. It's very, very handy and quite a nice application. Sounds like it's time for a cup of coffee, so let's go get one and fix it up just as you like it, and then come back and we'll finish up the show together with coffee. Okay, I hope you're enjoying your coffee, and, you know, it's been brought to my attention that some of you might be drinking instant coffee. I want to emphasize that that's wrong, that's the wrong way of doing this. Never, ever, any reason, no good excuse to resort to instant coffee. I don't want to sound harsh or anything, but I just want to encourage you not to drink instant coffee. Okay, so I was just recommending a handy and useful application called EPUB Reader. There's another handy and useful application called BomBono. B-O-M-B-O-N-O. I don't know why they call it that, but it is a DVD creator for Linux. DVDs I've never been in love with. I don't even love optical media, to be honest. I think it's horrible. I can't wait till for the day that optical media goes away. I don't see the value in optical media. I've been burned, as it were, way too many times by optical media. The way that it just, you know, the burns will fail, or the disks themselves will just suddenly one day it won't be able to read your data, you know, because you, I guess, got cheap DVDs, not knowing well enough to get the expensive ones. I don't know what the issue is. The thing is that I've been burned by these optical discs way too many times. They get scratched, they get smudged, whatever. They crack, they bend. They're just really bad form of media, in my opinion. So I'm fine with not ever dealing with optical media again. The sooner I can leave that behind, the better. However, some people still need it. Some people still use it. And sometimes it is... No, actually, it's not. I was going to say sometimes it is just the best way to deliver something. But actually, it's really not. It's never the best way. But sometimes it is a necessary thing. If you're going to show something and the only thing people have hooked up to a screen is a DVD player, then that's one of those times you'll need that. So BomBono is a great little application. It's one of those, I guess, dumbed down applications that normally I kind of don't like because, you know, I mean, especially in multimedia, right? I like to get my hands dirty. I like to really figure stuff out. DVDs, I have no desire to understand how DVDs are made. I can't stand the spec. I think it's a horrible spec. I hate menus. I hate the way that it muxes the video. I think it's stupid. So I have no desire to get my hands dirty with DVDs. I would rather just, if I'm going to burn a DVD, give me an application where I can drop my media file into the app and click burn, and I end up with a DVD that I can then throw into a DVD player and watch the stupid movie. And it turns out that BomBono is exactly that. It's a little bit beefier than that, actually. It actually has some really nice features, like if you need to make a menu, you can do that fairly graphically in this application. I don't know how fancy they are, but again, I've never thought DVD menus were really worth the time of day anyway. They're just so clunky and so badly designed and so annoying that I don't really know of a good DVD menu. The best DVD menu is something very, very simple. So you can do that in BomBono. And the process is that simple. You launch BomBono, you import the media file that you want to burn to the disk, and then you skip over some tabs that you don't really care about, and you click burn, or make DVD, whatever, and it's done. The cool thing about this, at least from where I'm coming from, is that it's almost a foolproof process, because, I mean, the actual DVD burning process itself notwithstanding, but in terms of creating the DVD, you import your video, and it does it for you. It burns the thing for you. That is strangely a great feature for me, because the software that I am accustomed to using on other platforms are strangely devious, and they'll let you add media, and they'll require you to specifically mark them as the first play item, meaning that if you don't give it that special tag of, okay, this is the first play, then you'll put the DVD that you just burned into a DVD player, and it sits there. It doesn't tell the DVD player to go anywhere. Doesn't take you to a menu, it doesn't take you to the video, it just sits there. some other ones do, they'll take you straight to the menu, but then if you didn't link the thing to the menu, then it won't ever, you can't ever get to the movie. Just all kinds of backwards things that these, for some reason, very popular software applications seemed to think were a completely reasonable default. Bombono's not like that at all. You drop your media in and you click burn, and you walk away with a disc that you can put into a DVD player, and it'll just play your movie, which is fantastic. So if you're looking for a quick and simple solution to burn video DVDs, and you don't want to have to understand the XML structure of the DVD menu schema, Bombono's the way to go. Doesn't need anything fancy. You don't have to do anything other than import one video file and click burn. It's really, really cool. And the nice thing about it is that, there's obviously other things that will do that. But the nice thing about Bombono is that you do have the other options if you need them. Like, okay, I want two videos. I'm gonna have to do the whole menu thing. Or I want two videos to play one after the other so I can, I'll link them together so that the DVD player knows to go from one to the next. So you can get a little bit fancier if you want to, but it's a really simplified application. Highly recommended. I feel like it's my duty, or maybe I just feel like I should probably get it out there so that when it all goes horribly wrong, I can point back to this episode and say, see, I told you so. But I feel like it's something that I should say about the internet, the state of the internet these days, and how horrible it is. And I mean this in a very specific way, in a very organizational way. For instance, so I was doing some stuff online the other day, specifically looking for a user manual for a big flat panel television that we have at the school where I work. And specifically I needed to know like what picture formats on an SD card this TV would recognize, because it had an SD card slot. So I wanted to see what all I could put on the SD card to then have it, you know, play on the television. So I was looking for this user manual, and I figured it'd be pretty easy. So I did the usual thing, and I went to the manufacturer's website, and I typed in the model number, got to the model number, saw all the fancy advertisements that they had for it, saw all the similar products, all the other products that I might like if I liked that product. No user manual in sight. So I did a search on the manufacturer's site for, you know, that model number plus user manual. No results. Like, zero results. Not even an advertisement. Just zero. They just said, don't know what you're talking about. So I thought, okay, nice try. Let's go out to the search engines. Went to a search engine, typed in the model number and the words user manual in quotes, and wouldn't you know, I get 6 billion returns. Of course, there are half a dozen sites that claim to be free, safe downloads, and they'll offer me all kinds of user manuals that are similar or that purport to be exactly what I'm looking for. There's a couple of other sites that review the product and happen to mention the word user manual. And then finally, there's some site in there that actually offers the user manual itself. So all in all, that kind of search result, that kind of process doesn't really impress me at all. Like, that's not what I would have expected from the internet. I like to try to go to the site that logically makes sense first, rather than going to a search engine and contribute to that, hey, everyone, dump everything into a big bucket and we'll try to sort it out for you mentality. I like to go to the site that should have the information that I'm looking for. You know, if I'm looking for a driver for a certain piece of hardware, I go to the manufacturer's website. It just kind of makes sense, you know? And you go to the drivers and downloads section, or maybe the support, and then to drivers and downloads, whatever. But going to a website and finding no useful information on something is kind of disheartening to me. And then you're kind of forced to go out to the search engines. Not that search engines are inherently bad, but I do feel like they really do promote a complete and utter lack of any kind of organization of all the information that the internet is supposed to contain. And at the end of the day, the internet is just that, right? It's a collection of information. And originally, especially originally, it was for information. I don't know if anyone remembers the old slang term, information superhighway. That was like what it was called back, way back when. That's how it came about. The idea was that this great big network had a lot of information that you could access. And that was an exciting thing. And it was kind of all about education and being informed and all these other cool idealistic sounding phrases. And now it just seems like when you're searching for something, you hit a bunch of ads and you try to avoid them and you try to find the actual meat of the article or the subject that you're looking for, can't find it. So you go out to the biggest advertising cesspool of them all, which is a search engine, and you do a search for the thing, and again you get a billion useless results until you finally sort through the big mess of fake hits and find something that approximates what you were looking for. And at the end of the day, I mean, this wasn't like an old episode of some obscure science fiction show or something like that. You know, I mean, this is a user manual of a current product on the market right now. There's no excuse, I don't think at least, for there not to have been that information completely on hand. That's the idea. That's the point of this whole network. That's why a company has a website, ostensibly, so that you have this information when you need it. The fact that companies and websites and web designers, and I put that in quotes right now, website designers, the fact that they are designing things and just doing things purely for look and have no idea of whether or not this thing will actually be functionally useful or not is just so frustrating to me. It really is. It's just so bad. It's exactly what the internet should not be. And if it continues this way, I feel like it's just going to be a bunch of pretty pictures. You know, it's who cares about any of the content, let's just make it look nice. And there won't be actually any substance on the internet at all. So that, I guess, would be the current issue with the internet that I'm hoping the geeks will fight against in some way. You know, I mean, I'm all for pretty looking sites. I like web design. I think it's fun. I think CSS is fun. I love it when sites look nice. But as I've always said, if you go to a website in a text browser and can't navigate the thing, then in my mind, it's badly designed. It should be well designed and it can look nice, but it should be well designed independent of its style, which of course was the whole reason for coming up with CSS in the first place. And in addition to that, there should be some logical structure to the information that you're putting online, because otherwise you're just adding to the noise. So I don't know, most of the geek sites that I go to, happily, are really, really well designed for information. You know, I mean, think of going to Debian.org, a great site. You can always find what you need on Debian.org. The Arch Wiki, fantastic, you know, phenomenal. All these sites that just give you a lot of information. Some of them are even nice looking. Some of them just look okay. I don't care. I'm in this for the information. So hopefully the geek crowd will continue that trend and fight the good fight against style over substance. And I should clarify that I'm not talking just about that there's too much junk on the internet, right? I don't care how much stuff on the internet exists. I don't think that's actually a big problem. GeoCities was a huge pile of junk on the internet for a very long time, and it never really got in anyone's way. I'm talking about the fact that the stuff that does exist online is very, very frequently very badly organized. People just aren't putting their data in a format that people can use. And I think that in order to build something that's truly useful and truly great, like the internet is, but could be better, then there needs to be some effort put forth. People need to design their sites. People need to organize their data. You can't just throw a bunch of information online and assume people are going to find it because of the magic of some big search engine. I feel like people are actually pushing us all towards search engines as the only way to access all of this data, and I don't believe that it's the most effective way. And I also believe that search engines are able to and will be able to continue, and they could continue it in a more insidious way than they do now, but they can control the information that you do find. Because, I mean, just because they can find it doesn't mean they're going to show it to you. There needs to be a way for people to directly access the information that you're bothering to put online. Otherwise, why are you even putting it online? Why bother at all, I guess? You know, just don't even get a website. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm arguing against. And I'm pushing for a more useful, informative, and better organized, smarter internet. So vote for me for president. I don't know. I don't really know the point. But there you go. That's my thought on the internet.
This is Ken from Hacker Public Radio. We're going to be recording episode 1000 soon. And to celebrate, 5150 is putting together a special show. He's looking for people to send in anniversary greetings. So please record a greeting today and email it to episode1000@hackerpublicradio.org. You can record it on your PC, on your phone or portable media player. And don't worry about the audio quality or file format. Just try to keep it short. That email address again is episode1000@hackerpublicradio.org. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to close the episode pretty much by giving you some Fedora-related news. Of course, in about 12 days, there's going to be a new Fedora release, Fedora 17. the Beefy Miracle is what they're calling it. I'm excited about the Beefy Miracle, or Fedora 17, if you will. I think it's going to be a really solid release. I think GNOME 3 is just going strong, strong, strong. I'm really, really just, I can't tell you. I love GNOME 3. I really do. I honestly do. I just found out the other day that Gedit, which I couldn't care less about in real life, but Gedit is available as a downloadable executable file for other operating systems, one of which we use a lot here at this place where I work, meaning that I actually have a viable, easy to install text editor that people could use and not have to be burdened down by the horrible text editor that comes by default with the OS. Such a simple little thing, but it's just such a relief, you know. It's just so wonderful when cross-platform stuff turns up. It really is. It's very cool. So I'm very happy about that. And GNOME 3 in general, I'm really impressed with the way it's been developing. So that's that. That's Fedora 17. Very exciting. The other exciting news for me is that people are finally starting to rebel against this whole release name thing. And it's been said a lot, so I don't know if I'm going to go on and on about it, but the release name thing is kind of stupid, pretty much. I mean, I don't know of anyone who talks about Fedora by name. You know, people don't say, oh, I started with Linux back on the Werewolf days, or back in the Sulfur days, or back in the Lovelock days. I mean, no one refers to it that way. And furthermore, why would we? I don't even know when in computing this little mini trend of giving operating system releases names started, other than from my experience in that industry, it has been a developer code. You know, like they didn't talk about the next release by number, because they weren't sure how it was going to be branded. Was it going to be a point release? Was it going to be a full-on complete new release? No one knew yet because the marketing department hadn't decided. So everyone just called it, you know, whatever, some name, some developer code name. It also kind of had, I guess, the additional advantage of two developers are out eating lunch one day, and they're sitting next to, I don't know, a tech columnist, and all they're, you know, they're talking about this new thing, this new Beefy Miracle or something, and to the tech journalist who's eavesdropping, it just sounds like they're talking about a great new hot dog that exists, have no idea that it's a new operating system that they're developing. Whatever. You know, it's got that sort of secret code word advantage. In terms of giving that code word over to the public and expecting them to run with it, I really don't get it. And I have a feeling it kind of started with a proprietary OS that I'm somewhat familiar with, where people started calling it very, you know, sort of very specifically by this set of names that the marketing department was giving it. And it was this public thing, and everyone said, oh, I can't wait for this code word to come out, because that's going to be really cool, because the marketing says so. And then, of course, there's the Ubuntu thing, where they really took it and ran with it and just started this sort of silly animal naming scheme, where they'd have some adjective combined with the illiterate animal. So you had things like Hardy Heron or something like that, or Grumpy Giffen or whatever. I don't really remember what they're called, but they would have those things. We're all aware of them. Pangolins, Precise Pangolin. And that kind of works for Ubuntu, you know? I mean, that's kind of like, that's what they've got. They kind of own that, I think. But Fedora, I mean, like, the naming scheme, there's like this sort of thing where, okay, it has to somehow relate to the previous name, but how do you go from, like, Lovelock to Beefy Miracle? I mean, actually it was Lovelock to Vern, I think, and then from Vern to Beefy Miracle. I don't really know. Point is, you can make anything relate to anything else, and the community would vote on them, and, okay, big deal. I mean, what is it to do? It's supposed to make us feel like we have a say in the way that Fedora is developed? We already have a say. We don't need to vote for a name that no one's going to use. Maybe it would be a little bit different if those names actually cropped up in the artwork, but there's been a fairly long-standing debate about that as well on the design team, and it's just kind of like they don't get those names in time to develop things that center around that concept. And I don't even know how you could do that anyway. Like, Beefy Miracle. Actually, our team's pretty darn good, so they could probably come up with something pretty snazzy that incorporated the Beefy Miracle into the artwork. Point being, I just think that the names are stupid, and I don't think they're useful, because I think that people end up, two releases from that time, they end up calling the stupid thing by the number anyway, because numbers make sense. They are linear. You can tell if you say, oh, I got into this whole thing with Fedora 8, then people know, okay, well, we're on 17 now, you got in at 8, so you've been using Fedora for this period of time, so we can kind of guesstimate as to what your skill level might be, or whatever we're talking about. It makes sense. Whereas, if you just say random things like, oh, I got in at Sulfur, well, what does that mean? No one knows. Or some people might know, but no one really knows. So, I think the naming scheme is stupid. They're going to relook at it. Unfortunately, I guess they didn't get enough of a response. Someone had done a poll on fedorapeople.org, and they didn't get enough of a response to kill it off completely, unfortunately. But they are going to relook at how these names are decided upon. And if you want to partake in that discussion, go over to fedoraproject.org. But I keep wanting to say there's a post on Fedora Planet right now specifically about this. So they will be discussing how the naming is going to be done in the future. And I hope there's a much lower emphasis on the name than just the fact that, hey, there's going to be a new Fedora and it is numbered this and these are the features. I think that's a much smarter way of doing things. That's obviously just my opinion. I'm sure a lot of people love the names and that whole thing. Although from what I've seen, not that many people love it. So, another cool thing is Fedora Reloaded is kind of back. Not my Fedora Reloaded, but if you know anything about Fedora Reloaded, you'll know that it didn't actually start with me and Skrillet. We were taking over the Fedora Reloaded moniker for someone else. From Wade Mealing and Joshua Wolf, specifically, were the people's names. And it's back now. If you go to AtmaYogi, AtmaYogi.com, AtmaYogi, that would be where Fedora Reloaded Reborn is living. I think as of right now they have all of one episode out, so I don't know if it's gonna be a weekly thing, a thing that goes on forever, I don't really know, but, I don't know, it's cool to see that it's, that name is kind of back again and that it's gonna be something that exists, because I missed it, you know, I would have not minded picking that back up at some point, but, it's just not something that I'm up for right now. So I'm really excited that, Fedora Reloaded exists again. I'm looking forward to more episodes from these guys. So, well, I mean, Wade Mealing apparently isn't a part of the new version yet. They say that they're going to try to get him back on board. So we will see what happens. It's very exciting development. I can't wait for more of Fedora Reloaded. So check that out. It's again atmayogi.com, and I'll try to remember to put the link in the show notes. I think that's it. I think that's all I have for you this episode. So thank you for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at newworldorder.info. You can chat with me online via Jabber. I'm not Klaatu at jabber.org. Or on Freenode in IRC. I'm in the channel Ogcast Planet, Slackware, Slacker Media. Usually I hang out in open source musicians a lot as well. So you can find me there. Or you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. And I think that's about it. So thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
know where we are.